From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. After Senator Maggie Hassan and many other Democrats call for Senator Al Franken to resign in the wake of new sexual harassment allegations, Franken announces his intentions to do so. Documents show Phillips Exeter Academy has a long history of not doing enough to report sexual abuse on campus, and women lawmakers and lobbyists describe a sexist culture at the New Hampshire State House. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them this hour. And we want you to lend your voice to the conversation. What about this week's news do you want to know? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange at NHPR or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. We've got a full house here in the studio today. Lots of voices ready to lend their insights to the week's news. Among them, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website Political Capital. Gary Reno, author of Distant Dome and writer for InDepthNH.org. And NHPR's own Paige Sutherland and Dan Tuohy. Thank you all very much for being here.
Good morning, Peter.
Yeah, good morning.
So we are going to start the show talking about Senator Al Franken, his intention to resign, what led up to it. We're also going to be talking about the prospect of increasing tolls on New Hampshire's highways. We'll be talking about a bill that will attempt to provide some leniency for people who violate parole if they need treatment for drug addiction. Again, the phone number for you to lend your voice to the conversation on one of those stories or a different story that appeared this week, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. All right. Senator Al Franken of Minnesota announced his plans to resign this week. He did so after a chorus of senators, including Democrat Maggie Hassan, encouraged him to do so. Start with you, Gary. Why did Senator Hassan decide to call for his resignation now, not last month, when that photo of Franken emerged, apparently having him grope a woman while she was sleeping?
Well, since the first photo appeared, there's been more and more coming out. It wasn't an isolated incident, shall we say. So I think the Democrats are really trying to grab the higher ground here. And they have the six women, Democratic women, come out. They're saying, hey, we're different than the Republicans. Republicans have got this kid, this guy who would like kids down there in Alabama running for Senate, you know, all this sort of stuff. So I think this is more looking at the 2018 election than anything else.
Dean, agree?
Yeah, it was, you know, I think two things are going on. I think part of it is genuine concern among women in the Democratic Party that the culture start to change. I think that's legitimate. I do also think there's a strategic component as well, but I don't think it's purely instrumental. I do think there's genuine concern about, you know, the workplace culture for women. But as Gary mentioned, you know, you've got Donald Trump, who's been accused of sexual assault by 24 women. You've got Roy Moore in Alabama, who's been accused of molesting a 14-year-old girl when he was in his early 30s. And so the Democrats didn't want to be put in a position of being seen as hypocritical. So they essentially pushed Al Franken out. If you heard him on the floor of the Senate yesterday, he clearly was not happy about this. He feels like it's, you know, that he's sort of being sacrificed, even though he disputes some of the claims. John Conyers, 88-year-old member of the House Democrat, is also step down. So they're basically trying to set up a clear distinction going into the 2018 election between how Democrats treat these allegations versus how Republicans. The argument we've heard mainly from Republicans in recent days is the people of Alabama will decide about Roy Moore. And when the press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, is asked about Donald Trump's the accusations of sexual assault, her comment is, well, voters in the United States put him in office, so that's already been litigated.
Mm-hmm. That's an argument I've heard, right?
Yeah, that's the argument that they're making.
Right. Well, people didn't know this about, allegedly did not know about John Conyers and Al Franken before their elections.
Right.
Now that they know, they're sort of, so is it a party thing or is it an order of operations thing? Like, you got to know before an election for this to be quote unquote okay.
Well, I think Democrats are setting it up to be a party thing. I do think there has been and some, even though Democrats were a little slow off the mark, I think there are some clear differences there now. But it is true that when you're trying to sanction elected officials, it's just a different process than, say, firing somebody from a corporation. I mean, in the end, you know, the Constitution is set up so that you can vote on individuals and throw them out of office if they don't do a good job. So in some sense, even though members of Congress can be sanctioned, they can be expelled, presidents can be impeached and removed from office, sort of the underlying dynamic here is kind of letting the electorate decide. And that's the argument that Republicans in particular are leaning on right now.
Okay. Let's focus a little more locally now, because this week NHPR's Casey McDermott reported on a culture at the New Hampshire State House that some women say would not be tolerated in other places. She's done some investigative reporting. She's talked to some people on how New Hampshire deals with sexual harassment in the workplace. Casey's out of town today. She couldn't join us for this part of the conversation, unfortunately. But here's an excerpt from Morning Edition's interview with her describing records in the New Hampshire House and Senate turned over to her on incidents of sexual harassment.
The House turned over a number of records. There have been about 10 incidents that have risen to the level of, you know, an actual complaint or something that would be documented over the last 2 years. Incidents that kind of spanned a broad spectrum of different types of harassment in the House, most of which, again, were dealt with informally, documented in case they escalated in the future. Now, the Senate was significantly less responsive in terms of turning over documents. The paper trail they did provide raised some additional questions that are worth looking into further, though. They held back a number of documents citing attorney-client privilege and personnel exemptions, but the records they did provide showed that the Senate paid more than $4,000 to a law firm that specializes in sexual harassment complaints for services that were utilized in 2013 and 2014. But the Senate wouldn't say what those services were, whether they were related to any specific incident or whether that incident was resolved.
And here's Casey McDermott also reporting on describing what those who worked at the State House told her about the alleged sexual harassment that they experienced.
Some people said they never had anything that they would consider to be sexual harassment. But a number of other people described basically a pattern of kind of casual sexism, sexual innuendo, unwanted advances from mostly male lawmakers. You know, for example, one lobbyist told me that after a committee vote, a legislator came up to her in the hallway, kind of caressed her arm and whispered in her ear, you changed my mind. And that interaction made that person feel very uncomfortable. Another lobbyist told me that in another case, she and a colleague were passing out policy literature. They encountered a group of male lawmakers, and one of the men invited the two young women to join them on a boat trip in their bikinis. So, you know, that kind of interaction in a professional setting is really kind of crossing a line. It's an institution in which the kind of inherent power dynamics really can make it difficult for people to speak up.
So that's Casey McDermott, NHPR's Casey McDermott, reporting on a so-called culture of sexism at the New Hampshire State House. NHPR's Paige Sutherland, you've spent a lot of time at the State House. If someone has an issue with the New Hampshire lawmakers' behavior, what can they do about it?
Yeah. So, you know, just to stand back a little bit, great reporting by my colleague Casey that we just heard from. And I think a big part that she made a point in her story is that when you break down the State House over there, it's an all boys club. You know, it's mostly older men. And when you look down at the leadership, it's mostly older men as well. So you're kind of going into an environment where if you want to get a bill passed, if you're a lobbyist, if you're a female lawmaker, then you kind of have to, you know, be cautious of the confrontations that you have. If someone says something, you know, unsavory to you, as you saw in the story, some lobbyists were like, it might hurt my business or the issue that I'm trying to get past if I kind of make a big deal about this, if I report it, if I come out and tell leadership. And so there are avenues to do it. But as Casey said when she talked to people, that some people were kind of scared to come forward and actually report it.
So scared, in fact. And you can check out the details of this story at nhpr.org. Fascinating story that some lobbyists actually had something of a buddy system, right? They would go in pairs to any encounter that may present an opportunity for someone to make them uncomfortable.
And I think that was the biggest takeaway that you saw from Casey's reporting is here's this big organization, New Futures. Obviously, everyone knows New Hampshire is grappling with this huge opioid epidemic.
New Futures, a group that's advocating for certain policy
drug
changes.
Policies, yep. Exactly. And so they're over at the State House constantly. It's a mostly female staff. They're really trying to get a lot of bills passed. They're dealing with lawmakers, like I said, mostly men all the time. And so they kind of had this policy, like you said, this buddy system. So they kind of changed how they did their job to address it instead of saying, hey, you know, this isn't right. We need to report this and change the culture over here. And as you saw in the article, it seems like they are going to report things now.
Lots of comments around the table.
Yeah,
go to Dean.
A quick point. Paige raised a really good point there. I've mentioned it here before as well. New Hampshire has one of the highest median ages of any legislature in the country. It's either the first or second oldest. I think it's something like 62 years old is the median. And it's because it's a volunteer legislature. You know, you're getting $100 plus mileage. So a lot of people do it are either people of independent means or more likely people who are sort of heading towards retirement. So I think there is a generational component to this, for sure, and I think that's part of what you're seeing and you're describing,
Gary.
And I think, I mean, as Casey alluded to, the first thing they probably would do when something happens is you go to the House Speaker or the Senate President and you tell them, and they'd probably call the representative or the senator in, read them the Riot Act, and say that this doesn't happen again. This is what you're not here. We're not here to do this. If that doesn't work, then you have the Ethics Committee. And the Ethics Committee can take this up. The complaint can be filed. It won't necessarily be public. If the committee decides that they're going to investigate it, which means they got to at least think there's something here, then it becomes public. But until that point, you never know about it.
Hard to know exactly what might be happening. I mean, because it's not a typical court of law, is it?
No, it's not.
All right. Well, Dan Toohey, you wanted to weigh in.
Yes, as Gary mentioned, the Legislative Ethics Committee, as Casey reported this week, in the past decade, they've only had one complaint, one formal complaint, which is quite eye-opening. And the reason why the former chairman or the chairman of the committee was pointing out is that a lot of these complaints are settled informally, you know, whether it's a slap on the hand or something like that, or it's a citizen legislature, as Dean mentioned. And that's why I think, you know, the public, if they go to the State House, they haven't been to the State House in quite some time, you realize a lot of these state reps don't have staff. They don't have a chief of staff. I mean, it's amazing. That's why you wonder, like, what is the chain of procedure for filing a complaint?
Mm-hmm.
But it's an aura that I think we'll hear a lot more of, or an atmosphere we'll hear a lot more of in 2018.
Is the fact that a lot of these cases are handled informally in some way enabling this quote-unquote culture of sexism?
I don't know if you could say that. I think some of these people that have raised the concerns in Casey's stories certainly believe so.
Paige?
I think another important thing, and Dean alluded to this as well, is that these are volunteer lawmakers. They're not employees of the State House. So I think that's a big thing of, you know, obviously here, like say at NHPR, we have workplace requirements of sexual harassment policies that if we don't follow, we get fired, where as a lawmaker, they're hired by the citizens who elect them. So it's kind of this different dynamic over there.
And one more thing, I mean, Casey's reporting on her main story. There is a form where people, listeners can look at and submit an issue if they've had an experience with sexual harassment, whether at the State House or at a workplace or another place. And reporters here at NHPR will review them and possibly follow up on it. And in those submissions or complaints to that form will be kept confidential and won't be published unless a reporter contacts them.
Great reminder. Thank you very much, Dan Toohey. Yeah, go to nhpr.org if you have information into or insights on the culture at the State House, whatever it may be. Allegations, of course, have to be checked before they are reported, so that takes time. So please do let us know as soon as possible if you've got some insight. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, and later in this hour, we're going to be talking about hearings on increasing tolls in New Hampshire's highways. Do you think the state should increase toll rates to pay for highway projects? How will it affect you if rates are increased? Will it affect you? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That number again, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Let's talk about another piece of news that happened this week, which is that New Hampshire is opting out of the federal first responder network known as FirstNet. We've been reporting on this on NHPR, and it's been reported on by many other news agencies, including WMUR, which had this tape of Governor Chris Sununu talking about it prior to the decision to opt out of FirstNet. Let's hear from the governor.
There's a lot of other states watching what we do. We'll be the first state in the nation to really make a true decision on what we do.
And so we've reported that New Hampshire will, in fact, be the first state to opt out of FirstNet, opting for another system. Bruce Cheney, who used to run the state's 911 system, has doubts about opting out of FirstNet. Here's what he had to say.
If this fails for any reason, then there are estimates that run in some cases up into the hundreds of millions of dollars for New Hampshire that will come out of taxpayers' pockets to fix the problem. No, it's all sort of a promise and a prayer.
Promise and a prayer, according to Bruce Cheney. But let's back up a little bit. Paige, you've been reporting on this. What exactly are we talking about? This first responder network, are we talking about its ability to communicate with other states? Is that it?
Yeah, so this federal program was created, the idea came about after 9/11 when, you know, first responders were scrambling, everyone was trying to help out, and kind of the wires got crossed, you know, it wasn't clear communication channels. And so basically it's a way to create when there's disasters, say a hurricane or a terrorist attack, anything that involves, you know, cross-state first responder help, that they'll have the channels to communicate freely as they need to do in a federal disaster. And so basically, you know, the FirstNet system, they have this deadline, December 28th, to states can either opt in or opt out. More than 30 states have decided to opt into this AT&T plan with FirstNet. And so New Hampshire is the only state, and looks like might be New Hampshire, maybe a few other states, not many other ones, that are saying, hey, we're going to go with our own provider, Rivada Networks.
Mm-hmm. Which, and why?
I think a lot of people still kind of have some questions of why, you know, Bruce Cheney, as you heard, he's saying, you know, here's this startup company, it's this new company, AT&T, as we all know, has done it before, you know, is this huge company that we know can get the job done, Rivada Network. Some people have some doubts of, you know, are they going to be able to create this network across the state? And if they don't, who gets left with the bill? The taxpayers.
Still certainly some wait and see with respect to FirstNet and how it's going to work in New Hampshire. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. So, Dean, you wanted to weigh in on FirstNet.
Yeah, just a little bit of a sense of why there's some concern about this or why some individuals think that they should go with the Rivada option. You know, my understanding is that the Rivada is claiming that the coverage will be better than the AT&T coverage. It'll be almost 100%. I think there's an opportunity, if there's excess broadband capacity with this network, to sell that, or in particular to get broadband service up into the North Country. And there's also some concern about people being required to have AT&T phones, and also uncertainty about what actual AT&T contracts would look like in the future. So, I mean, I think there's a sense that it's kind of a risk either way, but the big concern is that if they don't go with AT&T and there are any problems kind of with compatibility or having this come to fruition, there are going to be big fines on the other end.
Gary?
And I kind of think you have to look back a little bit at what happened at the Health and Human Services and the Medicaid billing and administrative contract. It's about a decade ago. They went with a company. They could have gone with several of the states who had put together their own programs, but they decided to go out on their own. And it was supposed to cost about $8 million. Well, I think it's 10 times that now, and it's still not exactly a flawless system. It hasn't worked out very well, and I think some people have the same feeling that this might be the same kind of problem.
All right, this is The Exchange on NHPR. To weigh in on the week's news, give us a call. The number 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Tolls, they might go up. Maybe not. Though the Executive Council earlier this week, in a non-binding vote, sort of lended some support, split 3-2, towards the idea of raising tolls on New Hampshire's highways, but there's still going to be some hearings. So maybe turn to you, Dan. What about these tolls? Like, what's the increase likely to be?
Well, the proposal that was submitted by DOT calls for raising, I think, $36 million a year and 54% of that would be from out-of-state drivers and operators. It's controversial, and as Gary can attest from covering local and state politics for 30 years, this is one of the third rails of politics in New Hampshire, tolls. It really is. I mean, people say the income tax or the sales tax or proposed income tax or sales tax, but when it comes to tolls, it really gets people aggravated. Like few issues in politics I've ever seen. So we have a number of people came out for the public hearing this past week in Portsmouth. There's two more public hearings next week, and potentially the council could vote on this on, I believe, the 20th of December. Mm-hmm. And right now they have, as Paige Sutherland reported this week, they have the votes to pass it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a preliminary vote on, I believe it was Wednesday. That was 3-2 in favor of this. So, but again, as Dan said, there's two public hearings. So, you know, that might change things up. And I think, like Dan said, I mean, a lot of people are against it. It will be a 27% increase statewide, mm-hmm. you know, 50% increase on 93.95, 25 cent on Spalding. So, you know, it doesn't sound like a lot, but if you're commuting back and forth a couple times a day, could really add up.
Gary?
I mean, everybody's got to complain about it, and everybody loves to talk about it, but I mean, it's the true user fee in New Hampshire. I mean, you don't have to use the turnpikes. You can take a road anywhere you want to go. You can get there. You don't have to use the turnpikes. It's people decide to use the turnpikes. Well, I mean, if they're going to decide to use the turnpikes, then you kind of have to support them. Mm-hmm. And this is the way you support them. I mean, we have spent a decade since we had the last toll increase. And that was a huge fight. When it lasted probably about 6 months before they finally went through. This one I don't think will last that long. But at the same time, I mean, it's so political. It's in the coming into an election year. We have Chris Pappas, who's one of the votes for it. He's going to be running for Congress. You know, it's going to get used against him mm-hmm. in that. But yet at the same time, he's from Manchester, and there's a whole lot of infrastructure that could be fixed with this toll increase much quicker in Manchester than if you had it.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the gas tax debate, and what did it take, something like 18 years to raise the gas tax the last time? So these are always hotly contested, and people feel, as is true if you live in a state where there's a sales tax or a state income tax, there's always upward pressure, you know, a little, you know, point here, half a point there, extra 25 cents, and people feel like they're sort of being nickeled and dimed in an unfair way. But you know, it is a measure of who's actually using the roads.
Mm-hmm. Gary, when you say that you don't actually have to use the highways, I hear lots of people out there in my head saying, wait a minute, I for all practical purposes, I'm not going to take side roads to get to work. Like, I need that highway to get to work on time.
But
Gary,
you're
shrugging.
But
you can. Yeah, I guess so. All right. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, speaking with a panel of knowledgeable people who've been paying attention to what's been happening in New Hampshire this week. We want you to join the conversation with your questions or comments. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email. That address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
We're asking Leadership Circle to play a very important role in expanding the capacity of NHPR.
Marshall Rowe is chair of NHPR's Board of Trustees.
We play a leading role in communicating what's happening in New Hampshire and how it's affecting all of us.
And NHPR's Leadership Circle helps to make that happen. Join the circle with your tax-deductible year-end gift at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website Political Capital, Gary Reno, author of Distant Dome and writer for InDepthNH.org, and NHPR's Dan Tuohy. It has been a busy week for reporters in the Granite State. Now's your chance to get some answers to questions about what's been happening in New Hampshire. Call us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're going to be talking about Phillips Exeter Academy for the next few minutes. And if you want to weigh in on what's been happening there with respect to reporting allegations of sexual assault, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And here on the line with us is Hadley Barndollar of Seacoast Media Group, who has been reporting on documents she requested as part of a Right to Know request that examine how Phillips Exeter Academy handled allegations of sexual misconduct on campus. Hadley has been wading through, I'm not kidding here, 900 pages of records and writing stories about what she's found in there. Hadley, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Good morning, Peter. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you as well. So you've published such depth in these articles about what's been happening here. But let's talk about the first one you published. It has to do with those 900 pages received from the Rockingham County Attorney's Office. What we've been talking about these documents. So what are these documents? What did they actually reveal?
So I kid you not, it was over 900 pages. Luckily, we did get an additional form. But anyways, so a couple months ago, you know, we were made aware that there was an ongoing state probe into Phillips Exeter Academy. We never really understood the depth of it until earlier in the month we were leaked some state police reports that said the arrest warrants had been drafted for these two deans accused of failing to report suspected abuse. So we submitted a Right to Know request to Rockingham County Attorney Pat Conway for the rest of the entire investigation. It took our office a couple weeks to prepare it. Her paralegal had to go through everything. But we got them on Wednesday evening, 900-plus pages, include about everything you could imagine. They include new allegations against, you know, faculty and former students accused of misconduct, abuse, you know, rape, and everything of that nature. And then we have a whole additional list of faculty members accused of violating this mandatory reporting law. There's letters going back to the 80s, to the 90s, communication amongst faculty members. It is a very hefty set of documents.
Yeah, you reported 16 faculty members are suspected of not reporting misconduct by faculty members and or students. That was according to a research memo that was released to you. The accused include, as you report, former principals, deans, coaches. This must be pretty alarming to the Phillips Exeter community.
It's definitely alarming. And, you know, we approach these documents with some sensitivity because, you know, it has been reported by the union leader today, and we knew this as well. You know, there are some current faculty members included on that list. But it's important to note that, you know, they have not been charged. These are allegations. They've not been formally charged with a crime. So we are kind of, you know, approaching everything with some sensitivity.
Yeah, including not actually publishing all 900 documents on your website yet, because you still have to properly redact things, correct?
Yeah, so we've actually received quite a few requests from, you know, very interested and concerned alum. Where can I get the documents? You know, my message to them is, as a news organization, we're not at liberty to release all of that sensitive information, much of which, you know, lists victims, alleged perpetrators, so on and so forth. So I'm basically directing everyone to go speak to Pat Conway, who completely controls release of the file. And it is public information, so members of the public should be able to get that information from her.
Pat Conway being county attorney.
Yes.
Okay. In September of this year, I mean, Phillips Exeter announced a memorandum of understanding with the Exeter Police Department and Rockingham County Attorney's Office that spelled out the protocol for reporting sexual assault. The state sort of mandates that anyway. But according to the documents you found, Hadley, it seems as though the school already had one of these dating back about 8 years ago.
So I think that was really interesting because this MOU was introduced, you know, it was a really big deal. It's a partnership with a lot of organizations around the state. Everyone was commenting, you know, Phillips Exeter has really stepped it up a notch. And at the time, it seemed that they were. And then we find out that, you know, this MOU was part of the agreement to not charge these two deans accused of non-reporting, that was an alternative option for Rockingham County Attorney Pat Conway. So to see that they did already have an MOU in place, you know, going back to 2009, it wasn't nearly as detailed, it wasn't nearly as specific, and it definitely had some discrepancies as far as a chain of command and who's allowed to report. But it is interesting that There was one prior to the one that was signed in September.
Mm. Is there any reason to believe that this argument would, or rather this agreement that was signed in 2009, change or possibly influence the decision on the part of the county attorney to not bring charges against these two deans for apparently not believing that you could prove these allegations beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, so the 2009 MOU designated the academy's principal as the only person that was able to communicate with the Exeter Police Department about alleged abuse cases. So essentially, if you're a teacher and you suspect some abuse, you needed to report it to your supervisor, and then your supervisor needed to report it to the principal. That probably can take a little bit of time. But now we understand that in the state of New Hampshire, everybody is a mandated reporter. It doesn't matter if you are a teacher. It doesn't matter if you are a coach. It doesn't matter if it's you or me. We are all mandated reporters to the state of New Hampshire if we suspect that a child is in danger. So that was definitely a difference that was emphasized in this MOU, and I think the Academy came pretty clear with that.
One of the names that was mentioned frequently in the documents that you received as part of this right to know request you made is Reverend Robert Thompson. Who was he and why was he mentioned so often?
So Reverend Thompson is a beloved figure in the Exeter community to many. His name came up in a lot of news reports beginning in the summer of 2016 when the Boston Globe reported his alleged role in how he helped to mediate a situation between two students. There was an alleged assault in the school's church basement. It's important to note that the assault was not directly reported to him. It had already been reported to two deans, and then he stepped in to try to reconcile the situation. People will know this as the monkey bread case.
And why exactly would they know it that way?
Because he actually, they came up with this compromise that the male student bake monkey bread weekly for the female student as kind of this act of penance, if you want to call it that.
Okay. So Reverend Robert Thompson assigned a sort of act of penance baking this bread. Mm-hmm. That was controversial in the news recently. But it doesn't stop there with respect to Robert Thompson.
It doesn't stop there. So when this all came to light in the Boston Globe that summer, he was placed on leave from the academy. He is still on leave from the academy. We're going on a year and a half later. And he has a gag order, so he has not been able to defend himself or speak to the media. But it has also, that instance has also raised other incidents in his past at the academy where he allegedly had a questionable role in handling alleged abuse situations or, troubled students. He's alleged to essentially have, helped out alleged perpetrators more than tried to discipline them.
Right. There's one allegation here in the report. I hope you can spell out some of the details for us. Former faculty member Carl Lindman was one of Robert Thompson's critics, according to the documents you found. Tell us about the incident that led to Lindman's criticism of Thompson.
Sure. So from what we understand, this was January of 1993. And there was a student who had set off some red flags for a lot of faculty members. He was in the middle of a discipline case, which means there's a discipline committee at the academy that reviews cases of punishment and so forth. So he was in the middle of a discipline case. And there was a weekend where he allegedly sexually assaulted a female student. And following that assault, Reverend Thompson went on to write a favorable recommendation for him to the discipline committee. And the allegations say that he passed his discipline review. He remained on campus for about another month until he was actually given a medical leave designation as his punishment for his alleged crime. He was never charged. He was never reported to police, as the documents say. So Carl Lindemann's, bone of contention was that Reverend Thompson's actions kept this student on campus longer, therefore placing other students in danger.
Mm-hmm. Thompson and has his supporters within the Phillips Exeter Academy community, and they say that he's sort of the scapegoat for the entire problem of how sexual abuse on campus is handled. Why would they say that?
Well, that's actually been, you know, the big outcry. And when he was first placed on leave, there was a huge, you know, outpouring of alumni support for him. He, as we know, is the only one who has been, you know, publicly punished in any of this. From what we understand, Melissa Mischke and A.J. Cosgrove, the two deans who were accused of non-reporting in this bread-baking case, per se, they are still on campus. They're in their posts. They're able to publicly defend themselves, you know, release statements. The school defended them. Some of Thompson's supporters say he has never had the opportunity to do that. The academy has never defended him, and he remains silenced on leave.
So where's this heading, Hadley Barndollar? Is there a court case on the horizon against the school or against one of these alleged perpetrators of sexual misconduct?
Well, I definitely know there are some mumblings, so we will definitely see. But there's 900 pages that still need to be, you know, pored through. So I can definitely say that there will be more stories forthcoming. There's a lot of what I call nuggets throughout those documents, so people can definitely expect we'll be doing a deep dive into some of them.
Well, this is Gary Reno. I mean, we've had reporting requirements in this state, mandatory reporting requirements for this for quite some time. Why does the school think that they had to send it all through the principal?
That's a really good question. Actually, the last time I spoke on this show a couple weeks ago, we had a woman call in who said that, you know, she worked at the academy, and genuinely most of the people that worked there were good principled people, but that there was this this feeling of a chain of command on campus, and that faculty members weren't properly trained to handle this situation. And I believe she actually referenced the principal being the only one allowed to speak to police at that time.
So, Hadley, as you pore through these documents, is there anything in particular you're going to be looking for?
I mean, I think more than anything, this kind of lays the groundwork from where we go forward. Like I said, there's a lot of names, there's a lot of allegations, and it's important to be careful with them. I do know that the Academy is getting ready to release their next installment of the law firm report by Holland & Knight. That's the law firm they contracted to do the investigation on faculty-student misconduct. So it'll definitely be interesting to see if some of those names match some of the names that we have here. And we're just going to try to get more corroboration.
Hadley Barndollar is a reporter for Seacoast Media Group. That includes Portsmouth Herald and Exeter Newsletter. She's published two articles so far on the contents of more than 900 pages of documents released as part of a right-to-know request on how allegations of sexual misconduct have been handled historically at Phillips Exeter Academy. Hadley, stellar reporting. Thank you very much for sharing your insights with us.
I really appreciate that. Take care.
You too. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We're talking about the week's news, and we'd like you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. That's NHPR Exchange. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on New Hampshire Public Radio. Let's talk about another story that came up in the week's news, and this has to do with the city of Manchester and a panhandling lawsuit. The city of Manchester paid $89,000 to settle a lawsuit over the city's panhandling policies. Gary Reno of IndepNH.org, who sued the city and why?
Well, there's a homeless woman who, whose name was Teresa Patello, I believe, and she was charged by the police with disorderly conduct under a an ordinance that the city had passed. It was very similar to other ordinances a lot of cities have passed. I mean, Manchester has been had a particular problem for a number of years. You have people up panhandling, particularly along Main Street, Elm Street, and it becomes a real problem when people trying to walk down sidewalks or just go anywhere. And there are people that used to be all over the place. They're not quite so much as they are now. And this woman with the Civil Liberties Union took them to court, and
They found, the federal court found that it was an unconstitutional ordinance, and they settled for $89,000.
So what implications might this have for other cities in New Hampshire who want to have ordinances like this?
Somersworth, Rochester, and Concord had very similar ordinances, and they've all stopped enforcing them because they don't want to get into the same situation.
All right, Dan?
Yeah, it's really something when you go to Manchester. It's not just Manchester, as Gary mentioned. Concord, over in the Seacoast, we've had some panhandles as well. It's really quite startling when you see it, and it's often in some very affluent areas of the state. The court case in September and the settlement, it really puts everyone back to the drawing board in terms of these policy leaders in Manchester and around the state on what to do in terms of support for these men and women who are panhandling. As the police chief in Manchester mentioned, it's a matter of public safety. He points out time and again, having these people sometimes on the in the middle of the road or on a median, and they're crossing traffic in order to solicit change. So we'll see some more policy decisions on this sometime soon, I bet.
Yeah, there was a big debate here in Concord over this whole issue. And, you know, for people who know the Concord area, we have this big commercial intersection at Loudoun Road and Fort Eddy Road where there's a lot of, you know, you get off the highway and there are a lot of businesses and, you know, sort of safety concerns about people, as Dan said, either standing in medians or on the side of the road. And there was this whole debate about kind of micromanaging the interaction between people in their cars and people on the side of the road. And, you know, homeless advocates got involved as well. And so, as Gary mentioned, I think they've stopped enforcing that particular ordinance now. But this whole discussion has kind of been fraught with a question of how to balance public safety with First Amendment rights.
I want to bring a listener voice into the conversation, not about this, but about a topic we spoke about previously. It has to do with the potential of increasing tolls on New Hampshire's highways. Let's go to Jim in Manchester. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Good morning, everybody. So with regard to the tolling, I particularly think that I support the increase in tolls because of the amount of work that needs to be done on the transportation side in our state. But in particular, you know, our incentives are upside down currently on the tolling system. You know, we reduced the $1 toll, for instance, and offer to 70 cents for those who use electronic tolling as an incentive to have people use electronic toll. Well, you know, it's a convenience. I think today most people would even be happy. I don't know happy, but they, you know, the premium should be on the other side. So the 30% increase in the tolls in order to encourage people to use electronic tolling could be eliminated. And I don't see people suddenly not going through electronic tolling because, you know, because of the lack of that incentive. I think the incentive is there for convenience, et cetera. So it's an easy decision to eliminate that 30 cents and go back to a dollar.
Well, Jim, thank you very much for your insight. We always appreciate listener comments with respect to anything we're talking about this this week. And we'll be talking about other things, too, including Hillary Clinton's visit to New Hampshire and her sort of the protest that occurred outside on the part of Vermin Supreme, the perennial candidate and performance artist, known for the boot on his head. We'll also be talking about some energy issues that were in the news this week, and sadly, the death of Mary Louise Hancock, who is a political icon here in New Hampshire. If you'd like to weigh in on this or something else in the news this week, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Gary Reno, author of Distant Dome and writer for InDepthNH.org, NHPR's Dan Tuohy, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And with you, we hope, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We want to know what's been on your mind with respect to this week's news. And just to let you know that in two weeks, on December 22nd, we will be covering the top New Hampshire stories of 2017. And we want you to send us your top picks for the top New Hampshire story of the year. Email us, exchange at nhpr.org. We want to know what you think is the most important headline of the year. So, all right. So let's talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton's visit to New Hampshire. She was promoting her book. Of course, so she was in Concord doing an event at Gibson's Bookstore. And ahead of her visit, Vermin Supreme made news. Perhaps, I don't know, too much news, Dean? Was he too much in the news?
Yeah. Well, you know, as you mentioned, Hillary Clinton came to Gibson's Bookstore in Concord. It was a successful event for her. I think they were at capacity in terms of the number of people they can have in there. I saw some people lined up outside. There were also a few Bernie Sanders supporters protesting out there. And then obviously, as you mentioned, Vermin Supreme, who apparently has a platform that says ponies for all, and he wanted to protest and have a live pony or ponies with him. And I guess the city was not happy about that, and he threatened to sue. And they ended up agreeing to, I think, a $75 permit so that he could have this pony. So, you know, what was so interesting was what social media picked up on was that Vermin Supreme showed up on both the covers of the Union Leader and the Concord Monitor in conjunction, pictures of him in conjunction with a story that really was about Hillary Clinton's event. And so, you know, he's run for president three times now. He's been on the primary ballot. Getting on the primary ballot in New Hampshire is not a hard thing to do. You pay, I think it's a $1,000 fee, and you fill out the paperwork and you're on the ballot. Anybody who's voted in the New Hampshire primary has seen that there are often two dozen candidates of all sorts on each ballot. So, you know, my theory on Vermin Supreme has always been that every New Hampshire primary, there is a new generation of young journalists in their 20s who come up here to cut their teeth on the New Hampshire primary, and they see this guy with a boot on his head, and they say, oh, that would be kind of a fun, quirky story to write for my particular media outlet. And that sort of keeps this thing alive every 4 years, even though it's kind of a, you know, for someone who's been here for a long time, it's kind of a tired shtick at this point for most people I talk to about it. There's nothing really new there. He certainly has a right to do this. It's a First Amendment right. But it keeps getting covered. And what was so interesting about these two newspapers was the two articles were by veteran journalists, Dave Solomon and the Union Leader and Ray Duckler and the Concord Monitor. My guess is they didn't choose the pictures. My journalist friends here could weigh in on how pictures are selected. But so, you know, he got a lot of coverage. It's kind of a tired shtick. He'll probably run for president again in 4 years. And people from out of state in particular to sort of get a kick out of covering him. I mean, I'm hoping maybe he'll change it up and maybe put an orange traffic cone on his head or maybe a jug of maple syrup. Change it up a little bit. The boot is getting kind of tiresome.
Dan Tuohy, getting old?
He probably has a wardrobe full of boots, right? I don't know. It's one of those things. He knows he has a flair for the dramatic. That's for sure. And I think he sensed the vacuum there. I mean, Hillary Clinton had this major event, but she was not speaking. She was signing books, and you know, there's approximately 1,000 books that she sold.
Not taking questions, and
right. It's a book tour, nothing more, nothing less, but very important for her supporters and friends in New Hampshire. Mm. And I, a friend of mine was number 985, and she waited in line for a couple of hours and was there till 4 p.m. But again, you know, Vermin Supreme saw a moment to capture or steal some of that thunder, and he took it.
I totally see your point, Dean, and the fact that it might be taking up too much oxygen, including too much oxygen here. But I will say that it is interesting to, in general, write a story about how a city decides to approve or deny a particular permit for a protest. I think that's interesting. Am I alone there?
Yeah, I mean, that was interesting. If you want to walk a pony down the street and protest, what do you need to do? But I learned that. If I ever get a pony, I'll pay $75 and walk it down the street.
Save your pennies, Dean. It's coming up. All right, so we'll talk about some other, I think, more deserving subjects right now. One of those has to do with a bill expanding sentencing flexibility for parole violators. It drew quick opposition from police and parole officer unions after the Senate Judiciary Committee recommended it Tuesday for a vote. This bill, Gary, known as House Bill 143, what exactly would it do?
Well, what it would do is if you violate your parole, the current law basically says you have to spend 90 days in jail before you can come up for the parole board again. Current law also gives some flexibility, but where there wasn't any flexibility was if it was a violent offender or a sexual offender. Mm-hmm. They had to serve their 90 days. This bill would say the parole board can waiver that 90 days, providing that you sign up for an outpatient substance abuse rehab treatment. It's basically aimed at people who have this problem, and to get them the treatment they need and to hopefully stop the cycle of coming back to prison. The big supporter is Donna Sitek, which is really no surprise. She has been a big advocate for many issues in terms of the penal system. She's now the chair of the parole board. Mm-hmm. And she was saying this really needs to happen. We need to have some way of treating these people without putting them back in jail for 90 days.
Mm-hmm. And opponents of this are saying what?
Saying it's this public safety issue. These people really need to be they paroled, they violated their parole. They need to be back in jail. They need to be off the streets.
Mm-hmm. So what's the next step for this legislation?
Well, it goes now before the Senate. It was held back, so it's going to come up in the first month in January. But on a unanimous vote out of the Judiciary Committee, I would suspect that probably it will go through the Senate. It's much different than it was when it was passed in the House, so they'll have to reconcile those two.
Okay. We promised we'd get to some energy and environment issues. So let's talk about this pipeline that Liberty Utilities wants to build. It's a new natural gas pipeline between the seacoast and Manchester. Dan Tuohy, why does Liberty Utilities want to build this?
Supply and demand, right?
Yeah, I guess so, huh?
Yeah, it's a 16-inch wide pipeline. It would go from the seacoast to Manchester, and you know they're trying to meet capacity. This is something that sounds like it's been in the works for a while, and it's finally coming to fruition. It's only about 27 miles. It's to be in the state's right of way there. So, as the Liberty spokesman said, there's be very limited impact to abutters and private property.
Mm-hmm. So what's it going to go through in order to become a reality?
Let's see here. It's still in the process here, but it's state approval process. It's the SEC, right, Gary?
SEC. It's going to have to go through the SEC process.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is the same process Northern Pass has to go through, right?
Right,
And so let's pivot then to Northern Pass, because they've got a few more weeks now for public to make comments on where exactly it'll pass through.
Well, we got two more weeks of public of the adjudicative hearings, and then they close the record at the end of the month, and then we have lawyers will be submitting their briefs, and then they'll start deliberations at the end of January to decide what they're going to do.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we've learned from all of this with Northern Pass, and I think Liberty Utilities is wisely doing this, and we also had the Eversource transmission project that was just completed. Use existing right-of-ways, if at all possible, and even better, bury the whole thing, which is what Liberty Utilities is planning on doing, and that will probably make it a little bit easier for them, although there is still this process that they're going to have to go through.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole thing with this natural gas is a big issue. Because we have such a limited constraint. Well, it's constrained in the middle of the winter when people are heating and during the heating season, and we have such a reliability. We need so much natural gas to generate electricity, so it becomes a real issue, and it can drive up costs, particularly in the middle of the winter. So they want to try to find a way to get more in here. It's more and more popular because it's cheaper and cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Another energy issue, or rather an environment issue that we should touch on, is that according to a study from UNH, more intense storms are making it harder for freshwater streams and rivers to act as filters for nitrogen pollution. Gary, are you familiar with the study?
I'm not really familiar with the study, but I'm familiar with the issue.
Okay. Well, how about you, Dan? Are you familiar with the study?
Sure. Yeah. Annie Ropeek, our new energy and environment and development reporter, had this story out of UNH. It's a study about aquatic nitrate retention, a fancy way of saying that what these rivers and estuaries, how they process water, of course, and their filtration system out to the sea and whatnot. And the story talked about, or the report talks about, during peak demand or peak flow and storms, how these estuaries have a difficult trouble processing these pollutants or whatever it might be. And today, actually, there's that conference over on the seacoast. It's the State of the Estuaries Project that's coming out today at noon.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. So we'll have to look forward to see what that actually says, that conference. A few minutes left in the program. Do want to touch on a few other news stories. One of them has to do with two public policy institutions in New Hampshire coming out with reports on the impact of the school voucher bill. One is Reaching Higher New Hampshire. The other is the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy. Dean Spiliotis, before we go into what these groups say about the bill, what does the bill do?
This is the bill that we're referring to as a voucher bill. It's to set up these educational savings accounts in which individuals will be able to get their portion of state funding and use it for private school, homeschooling, things like that. So it's sort of a modern version of what in the 80s we used to call a voucher program.
And right. What about these public policy centers? What are they saying that sort of has to do with the impact here?
Well, the Higher New Hampshire is basically saying this is going to have a devastating effect on schools, particularly on
schools that have on the low end of the spectrum where they have a very hard time raising money through property taxes. The whole issue here really is this free and reduced lunch, which is like a $1,800 that goes on top of the basic grant that schools get for each student, which is around $3,200. So we're talking about $5,000 per student. But we have what's called a cliff. It's the last cliff that remains in the education funding system. And it's if you have over 50-some-odd percent of students on free and reduced lunch, the whole school gets the extra $1,800 per student. So if you start pulling some of these students out, and it's those poor schools that are going to see these students get pulled out, then they're going to drop down below the 50%. And if they do, then they're going to be losing not just a few thousand dollars, they're going to be losing millions of dollars, some of these schools. So that's what the higher education was looking at. The Josiah Bartlett was basically saying, hey, we've had a larger drop in student populations over the last 5 years than this will ever happen. So you ought to be able to just, take care of it. It's not something that's going to be that big a deal.
And the issue is how much will the state have to reimburse based on drop in enrollment?
Dueling numbers, hard to figure out exactly what the impact will be. This is a story that news organizations across New Hampshire will be following because it's going to be a hot one in the next legislative session. So we're running out of time here. I did want to give some time to talk about Mary Louise Hancock, who died earlier this week at the age of 97. Dean, what do you think? We're certainly a huge loss to the political scene here.
Yeah, first female senator, state senator from the Concord area, I think in 1975. Over the years, had really become a must stop and visit for anybody running for the Democratic presidential nomination. And so Hillary Clinton visited her the last time. Basically, everybody stops by to see her. And yeah, so it is sort of a famous part of our politics in the state, particularly for Democrats and certainly with the presidential primary.
Certainly a huge loss to the state. Thanks very much, Dean, for your comments on her and for everything this show. Thanks also to Gary Reno of InDepthNH.org and NHPR's Dan Tui. We appreciate you guys being here this hour.
Thanks, Peter.
Great. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks also to NHPR's Paige Sutherland, who was here earlier this hour, as well as Hadley Barndollar of the Portsmouth Herald and Exeter Newsletter. The conversation about the news stories discussed today continues online at NHPR.org and on our Facebook page. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening to NHPR, and have a great weekend.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth-Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth-Hitchcock is here.